Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Alami Podcast, Change Your Company. My guest today is Richard Jolly. Richard is an adjunct professor of organizational behavior at the London Business School, where he received many teaching awards. He's also the director of the organizational consulting firm Stocks and Jolly Consulting Limited. Richard's primary consultancy interests focus on designing and delivering executive development workshops, coaching senior managers, and facilitating senior management teams with an emphasis on leadership and change management agendas. He has worked with leading companies representing a wide range of sectors, including Barclay, Carlsberg, Clarion, Danone, Deutsche Bank. The list goes on and on and on. It includes also the World Economic Forum. He received his MBA with distinction from the London Business School. Hi, Richard, and thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Fouad. Great to be with you.
Your experience working with executives from all over the world, from this wide sectors, and also teaching MBAs, and of course, the MBAs, it includes executive MBAs as well. So working with all kind of leaders and senior managers, it gives you this insight about the challenges that these organizations face and these leaders face. But one of the things we were chatting about before was organizations being as socio-technical systems. What does it mean?
So this is a concept that was really developed in the 1950s by Eric Trist and others, and it's still, in many ways, it's a concept that can be. It's the same concept described in many, many different ways, but I think it's a very profound idea that is more relevant today than it has ever been. The concept is best illustrated by a study that Eric Trist and his colleague Ken Bamford did in the mining industry. And what happened in the 1950s is that they introduced a new technology because before the 1950s, they did what they call short wall mining. And basically, you have a drill, then you drill into a seam of coal, and then you gather up the coal and put it into crates, and it gets taken up to the surface. And what happened was they introduced this long wall mine where you have a rotating drill that goes across an entire seam of coal, and it's much more automated, and it should have provided significant improvements in productivity. But it didn't. And so they brought in these consultants, these psychologists, to figure out what was going on. And the finding that they had is that whilst the technology had improved, they'd focused only on the technical system and then completely ignored the social system. Because you had this community of people who worked in a very close-knit team, and they were obviously often family members, but certainly the team was the core unit there. And they'd broken up this team, and you know, there's a longer story version of it. So what they then did is they reconceived the new technology so it could work with the social system. And so the key concept here is that an organization, if you're going to be successful, you need to pay attention clearly to the technical system. This is the processes, the systems, the procedures that we have to allow us to be successful. But you also need to pay attention to the social system. And so when you look at in any intervention in organizations, whether it's internal or from external consultants, the challenge is to focus on both the social system, the people side of it, as well as the technical system. And if you don't pay attention to both of them, then my experience has been very consistently, you'll be much less successful. So any executive and any consultants will typically have a preference. They're more technical system people, the more social system. And the risk is that you devalue the other side of it, saying, all this social system, it's soft, fluffy nonsense, it doesn't matter. All this technical system is boring, it's people that matter. And so the key insight for me about socio-technical systems is you need to pay attention to both sides of it.
Yeah, and what does it mean, taking care of the social aspect of it? What would it include?
Yeah, well, the language used today is the classic concept of employee engagement. And really, in 1911, I would argue the most significant management book in the history of business was published. And this was The Principles of Scientific Management by Frederick Winslow Taylor. And in it, what he did is, you know, with the explosion in the 1880s of mass standardization and manufacturing, what Taylor managed to do is, in the Principles of Scientific Management, is really codify that into this mass standardization. And, you know, it's famously described by Henry Ford as any color so long as it's black. And if you do focus on the efficiencies here, you focus on the technical system. But the problem with scientific management, and it was a problem in those days, because even during Henry Ford's lifetime, the Ford Motor Company lost its dominant position in the automotive industry, because along came General Motors, run by the rather magnificent Alfred P. Sloan, who said something very important. He said, "There's a funny thing here at GM. We pay for their hands. We could get their heads for free." And I would argue that ever since 1911, organizations have been struggling and wrestling with exactly this issue. How do you get people to bring more than just their physical labor, their hands? How do you actually get them to care about the organization? And the language we use today for this is employee engagement. And, you know, there's very powerful data here which says that organizations with higher level of employee engagement will be more profitable and more sustainably profitable than ones with lower levels. So, you know, even just simply focusing on how engage our employees, would they recommend to their friends that they should work at this organization, is something that if people aren't excited to work there, well, they have choices. And particularly with this millennial generation now becoming a potent force in the business world, they're much more demanding of actually an environment here, a context around them that actually is motivating and energizing for them. So I'm not saying the millennials want different things. For me, they're just more demanding and they want exactly the same things that all of us want. We want to be part of a coherent social system that treats us fairly, treats us with respect, where we understand who we are and where we're going as an organization. And we feel we can use our strengths to really help the organization achieve its ambition.
Yeah.
So that's for me what social system really means.
Yeah. And if we look at the time since this book was published and where we are today, it's like a century. One could have imagined that there have been like a lot of improvement, and today it's almost all of this solved, but it doesn't look like it, right?
No, and I think it's got worse. And you know, all the studies of employee engagement are depressing. I think the latest study I saw is that this was before lockdown, even, is that 79% of employees across, you know, this is millions of executives who've been studied, actively disengaged. So for them, it's just a job. They don't really care about the organization. They're not going to go beyond what is expected and required to really, you know, bring their heart and soul to the organization. So it's got worse. I think there was a key point for me where there was, in a sense, a tipping point where things really got worse. And this was, for me, in the mid-80s. So a number of things happened in the mid-80s. Clearly, you know, the arrival of technology into the office environment. And some of us can remember life before email and when we had telexes and fax machines and such like. But what happened when technology became more pervasive is that the entire world of business was flipped on its head, because before the mid-80s, the more senior you got, the less time you spent working. And it was, you know, the mill owner wasn't working as hard as the mill employees. The bank manager wasn't working as hard as the bank clerk. But what happened is, the mid-80s onwards, every year, basically, the more senior you get, the more hours you worked. And so what we've seen is this increasing polarization, where there is one group of people who are very money-rich and time-poor, senior executives, and there's another group who are very time rich but money poor. So in Europe, we have the European Working Time Directive. And so you do see this real polarization between the people who are earning lots of money but are working incredibly long hours, and people who are actually working shorter and shorter hours but actually earning much less money. So I think the people watching this podcast will clearly fit in one of those categories more than the other. This is the problem, is that we can now spend, particularly during lockdown, our entire life working. Because the traditional boundaries between work, commuting, and what we used to call life have completely evaporated. And in fact, this concept of work-life balance, for me, is a completely useless concept because there's various assumptions embedded within it. The first assumption is that there is something called life and something called work. And that life is good and work is bad, and the boundaries between them are clear. And all of these are completely false assumptions. So I don't think it's a helpful concept. For me, what I talk about is complexity management. And certainly today, our lives are much more complex than they have been since few months. But this is really a factor that's been getting more and more complex, particularly since the 1980s.
Yeah, and you say that in complex times, we seek some, we oversimplify the answers, right?
Sure. So there's a problem here with the human brain. And it's a pretty fundamental problem, which is the human brain doesn't like complexity. Just the way neurologically it works, it looks for simple connections. And so human beings, we really don't handle complexity well. We like things to be black and white, good and bad, right and wrong. And so you see this in popular culture. You see it, for example, in Hollywood movies. Every Hollywood movie, there's goodies and there's baddies. And, you know, the baddie is going to do well for a while, but in the end, the goodies are going to win. It's a standard setup because it's so reassuring that there's good and bad in the life, and it's sort of very validating. You see it in tabloid journalism. You see it increasingly in the political world, where it's all about good and bad. It's binary, black and white. The problem is that if you have to always look for black and white solutions in life, it means you can't deal with complexity. You can't deal with not knowing, what's been called negative capability. That ability to stay with not knowing is that there's a lovely quotation from F. Scott Fitzgerald, the author of The Great Gatsby, who said, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function." And now more than ever, that ability to just stay with complexity rather than looking for simple or simplistic answers is absolutely critical. I think there's a really nice example of this from, not from business, but from biology. And the technical term is not very helpful. It's Ashby's principle of requisite variety. But what Ashby basically said is, if you're in a simple environment, you can be a simple system. So, for example, the ocean is very, very stable over hundreds, if not thousands, of years. So you can be a jellyfish or, even a single-celled pseudopod, and you don't have to evolve or adapt very much because you're in a stable environment. However, if you're in a complex environment, you need to be a complex system. So given just how complex the business environment is today and has been increasingly for the last few decades, let alone the complexities of the pandemic, you need to be a complex organization. But what complexity means is you're going to have contradictions, you're going to have inefficiencies. It can feel a little bit like a Franz Kafka novel at time, where things don't connect. And so we have structures here that are complex, the matrix structure, dotted line reporting relationships. You have complex strategies. You have complex organizational cultures with lots of different sub and countercultures. And some people find this completely overwhelming. But for me, this is one of the key challenges for leaders today, is the ability to stay with complexity, to make decisions when we need to. And right now, being decisive in key areas is important. But you've got to be able to stay with that complexity rather than reduce things down in ways that are unhelpful. And there are, again, so many examples of where leaders, both in the business world and in other environments like politics, for example, have really struggled with that.
Yeah, it's very interesting what you say about, like, we need complex systems, but the way, because usually a lot of people say that we need to simplify, but I think when you would explain what complex system is, it makes very much sense, you know, that there are subcultures, there are like different localized approach for a global company, for example, and yeah. all this kind of thing, they have to exist, otherwise you will not be able to be successful.
Yeah, and we've done some studies over the last 3 years where we have interviewed CEOs, and it's been fascinating because they're saying different things than they used to say. Because, and I'll come back to exactly what they say, but the metaphor here that really resonates with me is thinking about an organization like a mountain. And it used to be the case that you start your career at the bottom of the mountain, and it was foggy. You couldn't really see what was going on. And basically what you do is you'd work hard and, you know, climb up the mountain, you know, occasional bloodied fingernails and bumps and scrapes, try to keep your head down and avoid making too many mistakes. And if you were worked hard and did a good job and had a good bit of luck, then you would rise up the mountain. And what would happen is that eventually you'd get to the top of the mountain, part of the executive committee, the C-suite. And there you could see clearly. Because after a while, the clouds us and you can see a great distance. And so the traditional framework, and you know, academics like John Cotter have talked about this for decades, was that the challenge for the senior manager was to set the strategy. And so the metaphor here was a bit like, you know, the senior management have some vessel of wisdom and insight. And what they do is they pour it down the mountainside, and it cascades, to use the management jargon here, down the mountainside, nourishing people as it goes. And there may even be a few drops for the little people at the bottom of the mountain. And this is how organizations were led. When I first started teaching leadership and change at London Business School 20 years ago, this is what we taught, how to cascade, you know, set the vision and strategy and cascade information and then monitor to make sure people are actually doing what you tell them to do. The problem is, in these studies we've been doing recently, senior executives, CEOs are saying, you know what? I don't know what the answer is. It's too foggy here. Because now, as you get more senior, the clouds don't part. And this is even before the pandemic. So, you know, in the UK, what's going to be the impact of Brexit? Well, it's complex. We've never done this before. You know, Europe wasn't designed to be left. All these issues, trade wars that are happening right now, and obviously more recently, the pandemic, you know, these are things where it's very foggy. What on earth should we be doing? When can we get together again as a senior management group? When can we, from my point of view, get groups of senior executives together to do, you know, development work? Well, the answer is, we have no idea. And so that's one of the problems right now, is that it's just foggy as you get senior. And the key issue here, and for me, one of the most exciting and fundamental shifts that I see in organizations over the last 20, 25 years, is that the best ideas don't come from the executive suite. The best ideas increasingly come from as far away from the executive level as you can get. Because the people closest to the problems, particularly closest to the clients or the customers, who are the ones who actually you've got probably the best ideas, because they're connected to it day to day. And so that ability for senior managers, not just to be cascading with the sort of gravity-fed model, but to be really open to ideas from every part of the organization, that is absolutely fundamental, not just to agility, to creativity and innovation, but to actually creating, going back to our social system, that real profound level of employee engagement. Does everyone feel that they can really contribute to the success of the organization, or are they just waiting to be fed from this vessel?
This is great insight. What would be a practical application of this, like for leaders, like to get this insights on a regular basis or continuous basis?
It's a great question, Fuad. The Greek Stoical philosopher Epictetus said, we have two ears and one mouth, and we should use them in that ratio. Certainly, my experience is that most senior executives spend much more time sort of talking than they do listening. And so how you actually institutionalize this into the technical system. This is not just a social system of going around shaking hands, saying, you know, like some sort of member of the British royal family, you know, how do you do? What's your name? Oh, jolly good. This is actually about genuinely making people feel engaged, but also getting the ideas into the organization. And I'll give you my favorite practical example of this. And this goes back to General Electric and the great Jack Welch. When he took over as CEO and chairman and CEO in 1981, this is one of the most respected organizations in the US. His predecessor, Reg Jones, had been voted the most successful CEO in North America. So it wasn't a broken company. But in his 20 years as chairman and CEO, he grew the market capitalization from $19 billion to over $500 billion. When you look back on it, he said basically the thing he did that had the most impact on that transformational journey was a process called Workout. And Workout is breathtakingly simple. And they piloted it in 1984 and then rolled it out across GE in 1985. And Workout, what you do is you get a group of people together who work together, and you send them off to a hotel room for 2 days with a facilitator. And either give them a general question, which is, how can we make things better around here? Or you give them a more specific question, which is, how can we increase sales? How can we improve quality? How can we cut costs? Whatever it may be. And over the 2 days, they work, supported by the facilitator, to come up with a series of recommendations. And at the end of the 2 days, a member of senior management arrives, and they present these recommendations to that executive. And that executive is allowed one of three responses to each of these proposals. Number one, let's do it. Number two, we're not going to do it because... Or number three is, I'm not sure you fully understood it, let's gather more information. Now, in the early days, there were some examples of, you know, people thinking this was some sort of game, some negotiation, and asking for outrageous things. But what they found is, if you treat people like adults, they behave like adults. And this is the thing with scientific management, you typically treat them like children, which is creating a dependency model, do what mummy or daddy tells you to do. So since 1985, they've done hundreds of thousands of these workouts at GE. And what they found is, of all the recommendations that have been made in these sessions, the percentage that are instant and automatic yes is 80%, 80%. And wow. For me, it's just such a great example of actually, you know, it's a simple thing here, which is talk to people. And talk to people doesn't mean, you know, standing on top of the mountain, you know, with your vessel of wisdom and insight, giving your charismatic speech about this, you know, is the future and this is our strategy. It's not about some town hall meeting, because to be honest, in my community, we do have town hall meetings and we get together as a local community when there's an important local issue. We have lots of social interaction, catching up. People bring food and drinks, and it's a really fun time. Then we have a discussion. Everyone gives their point of view. We make a decision, and then we follow through on it. And we're very effective at doing that. That's what a town hall meeting looks like. But in organizations, that's not what most town hall meetings look like. A town hall meeting is typically a senior executive who gives their PowerPoint presentation and tells everyone this is, you know, what we need to do, and then has a Q&A at the end. And very often in the Q&A, they know you have to be an idiot to actually raise your hand and ask a question or dial in and ask a question. They're typically planted questions in the audience. And so somebody will say, what about this? So that's a great question. And there they go with their next PowerPoint slide to answer that question. This is not two-way interaction. It's not a dialogue. It's just a monologue. It's just cascading. And I think that for me, the GE example of the workout process, just simply saying to people, how can we make things better around here in a way that's meaningful? And you can take it, you know, more extreme examples recently. the whole concept of radical candor, and Bridgewater and Ray Dalio has done a great TED talk about just how extreme their communication systems are, and really in the technical system, not just the social system, it can get pretty radical to actually genuinely in a sense, turn the organization on its head where everyone has a voice.
Yeah, it's a great examples that you've been sharing, and the one about Jack Welch. Actually, Jack Welch was known being Neutron Jack when he first took the helm of GE, and he was just taking decisions, and he wasn't that on the other side, and then he made the shift, and the shift. I mean, in his book, actually, he said that this was the most powerful thing that he did or he initiated in the organization.
Yeah, I mean, when he took it over, it was very successful, but I think he fired 70,000 employees, which is, more than most of us have fired in our careers. And everyone was complaining about it. But what he did is he got it fit and lean so that it was perfectly positioned with the right strategy to really then go through this period of explosive growth. But it wasn't just strategy. It was about the way that he really was absolutely obsessed by getting ideas from below him in the organization and radically reducing the layers of hierarchy. Lots of things he did and again, reading about him, it feels like a long time ago when you look at GE today.
Yeah.
But I would argue that when Jeff Immelt took over in 2001, clearly it wasn't a great time. It was a couple of months before 9/11. To be honest, I think the principles that made GE great still are valid for organizations today. They just haven't been followed at GE.
Okay. So this is the reason you think it didn't continue with its successful path.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's complex, and I don't want to reduce it down. Yeah. I would certainly argue, I've done some work with different parts of GE over the years, and I would argue that it kind of lost its way in terms of having that, laser-like focus on really great ideas and empowering people, rather than becoming increasingly bureaucratic and hierarchical, which is what happened, I would argue, under Jeff Immelt, which for me was not... was certainly a key part of why the organization has destroyed so much value in the last.
Actually, one of the things they were famous for was leadership development programs and the development of the people. And at the end, they had to get a CEO from outside, which was the first since long time, I think.
Yeah, and Crotonville, their training center, was just, and that's the exemplar of world-class executive development, and many great people, Steve Kerr and Todd Jick and others have, really been involved in setting up, running, and contributing to Crotonville over the years. But sadly, it's a shadow of its former self today.
Yeah. So if we go back to this point about the socio-technical system and we look at the social part of it, is the challenge the system itself, like the hierarchy, the functional setup? Is it a leadership mindset or is it a leadership skill set? Or is it a combination of the three?
I think it's a combination. The best way of illustrating it for me goes back to a story told by the greatest professor we've ever had at London Business School, without doubt, I would argue, the wonderful Sumantra Ghoshal, who sadly died in 2004, well before his time. And I had the privilege of working with him for 5 years. And he was famous because with pretty much every group he ever taught, he shared the same story. It's a story that's resonated with executives around the world. And in it, he describes two very different environments. And these are personal stories to him, so I won't tell the story in any detail. But he basically says that, he's from India, from Calcutta originally. And he takes his children and his family back there during the summer to visit their relatives. And he says, you know, Calcutta in the midsummer, it's, you know, over 100 degrees, it's 99% humidity, and you just feel tired the whole time. You have no energy. He then says, I moved to work at a business school in just south of Paris, in Fontainebleau, and some of you will know which one he's referring to. And he says, if you walk in the forest of Fontainebleau in spring, it's this beautiful ancient forest, and you just feel the sense of energy. You just feel this vitality. You want to run. You want to throw a stick. You want to just feel energized. And he says, these are two very different environments. What does it feel like in your organization? Does it feel more like downtown Calcutta in the middle of summer, or does it feel like the forest of Fontainebleau in spring? And there's a spectrum here of the sort of context we create, because a lot of organizations, they say, oh, you're not motivated, you're not performing. Well, and in fact, in some organizations, people are very critical of the employees below them. I always find that to criticize people below you, I always find that a strange thing to do, because it may be that they're not performing, but whose fault is that? Did you hire stupid, incompetent people? Well, if you did, you can't blame them for being stupid and incompetent. You just hired the wrong people. But that's typically not the case. Typically, you hired smart, competent people who are not performing well. So what's happened there? Is it their fault? No. The point is the context we create in organizations defines people's levels of energy, their levels of engagement, and their productivity. So the challenge, I think, for all of us is to really build this energized, engaged organization. And so in my research and in my consulting work, there's a spectrum I talk about, which is something that for me was an intuitive sort of insight I had, having worked with many organizations. I've lectured, consulted in, I think, 41 countries to date. And some organizations just are more successful than others in the same industry. And I was trying to figure out, why are they more successful? And typically, it wasn't a strategy issue. Strategy, increasingly, I would argue, is not what differentiates successful from unsuccessful organizations. And so I was struggling with this for a while. And then I thought, you know what it is they just seem more confident. And so what I talk about is this confidence spectrum. On one end of the spectrum, you have overconfident organizations. And they're arrogant, hubristic, you know, sort of bullying, intimidating. Yeah, we're the best. You guys are losers. And on the other end of it, you have the underconfident organizations, the victims, you know, what Martin Seligman calls a learned helplessness that can lead to this passive behavior. And my thesis here is great organizations spend more time in the middle of that spectrum, whereas less successful organizations are bouncing between over and under confident attitudes, often in the same meeting and the same day. Yeah, we're the best. No, and there may be underlying it in a sense of inadequacy or insecurity. And so what it leads to for me is an important question, which is, what are the characteristics that allow organizations to spend more time in the middle of that spectrum? That's what I've been studying and working with executives and organizations, is what does that really look like? And so there are a few critical things that are not going to be particularly surprising here, but for me, consistently differentiate the organizations are able to stay centered there rather than bouncing between the extremes. The first one is you have this sense of ambition, a sense of how the future could be different and better. And we can use, I don't really like the vision word.
Why you don't like it?
Yeah. Vision is what happens to you when you've been in the desert for 2 weeks without any food or water. That is sort of some sort of out-of-body experience being visionary. It's away from reality. I have no problem with using vision. It's not the word I think is most helpful here, because it feels like it's rather sort of an out-of-body experience. We want to be the McKinsey of, we want to be the Procter & Gamble, the GE, or when, you know, we make ball bearings, or we're a small consulting firm. And often it can lead to, I think, things that are unhelpfully disconnected from reality. But again, I have no problem with, you know, companies having vision. What vision really means to me is having a sense of ambition, how the future could be different and better. And we need to have a clear sense of that. Wouldn't it be great if we could achieve this? And there's a whole bunch of academic sort of frameworks around this that support that organizations that have that sense of ambition, have what we call a higher level of construal, are going to be more successful. And it's a simple thing. If you go to organizations, I've done on many times, and you ask the senior management, do you have a vision and strategy? They always say yes. Second question, have you communicated this to your people? They always say yes. Then I go, okay, I'm sure that's true, but let's just go and check they've understood. And you talk to the employees and say, do you understand the vision and strategy? And they almost always say, no, we don't understand what it is, and we're not even clear on it, let alone being motivated or engaged by it. In fact, Kaplan and Norton did a study a few years ago where they found that 95% of employees are unaware of or do not understand the company strategy. And so when you go back to senior management and you say, they don't seem to understand your vision and strategy, they get irritated. They say, what's wrong with these people? I told them what the strategy was. Didn't they listen to my speech as I cascaded the information? But it's completely not understanding really what it means to effectively communicate. So the first thing is having a vision and strategy, having this ambition. But the second one is being effective at communicating. And most senior managers think they're world-class communicators because they have hundreds of PowerPoint slides. But actually, that's not how we learn. We don't learn through PowerPoint. In fact, there's a whole movement against PowerPoint called PowerPointlessness because, you know, whilst I have no problem with PowerPoint, the way most executives use it is just, you know, bullet points, data, graphs, slides. And what I mean by effective communication is the ability to tell powerful stories. So what I've tried to do just in our conversation here is use examples, stories, metaphors, be it the example of the long wall versus short wall mining, be it the story of mountain and cascading information, because all human beings learn through stories. And getting better at telling stories is a crucial skill, I would argue, for all executives. Yeah. So if having a vision strategy is important, communicating it, and then, you know, communication also involves the ability to listen, ask questions, and make sure there's a dialogue rather than just one-way monologue. Yeah. And there's a bunch of other things as well, but these are some of the absolutely critical things that really define what I would call confident organizations.
Yeah, I think it's a great way how you describe it and what differentiate confident organization, not overconfident and underconfident. But the one point, I think you said it, and I liked it a lot, about they don't understand it. But I think maybe in the really confident, the one in the middle, it's not about just understanding it. They are even excited about it. Yeah. And this requires even a like higher level of leadership capabilities. Do you agree?
Yeah absolutely. It's funny, when you go into organizations and you say, do you understand the vision and strategy? Most people just don't have no idea, don't really care. It's just a job. It's just a transaction. It's an instrumental relationship. It's focusing on the extrinsic factors, as Hertzberg would say, rather than the intrinsic motivations. But there's some organizations, you go in there, where people, not only can they tell you what the ambition is, but they tell you with fire in their eyes. You know, they are in the forest of Fontainebleau. And there's one charity in the UK, Macmillan Cancer Support, where they were asked. Every single person in the firm was asked, "What's the ambition for the firm here?" Every single person who was asked said exactly the same thing, and they said it with so much fire in their eyes. They were on a mission. And it was basically, the cancer rates are growing so much, and then we have to create the support structures in society to really help people and their families cope with this real increase in this devastating disease. Even the temporary receptionist who was on doing maternity leave, maternity cover, could say exactly why this organization existed, why we're here, and just be so inspired by it. And that's charity and it's cancer support and it's easy, but I've seen this in so many organizations. I'll give you another example of it. There's a Danish chemical firm that I work with. I was working with one of the senior executives there who said, he told me a story. He said, my daughter started at a new school recently. And on the first day of school, we dropped her off, and there was a coffee morning for the parents to get, you know, to meet each other. And I was chatting to somebody else, this other person said, "Where do you work?" He said, "I work at this chemical firm." The guy said, "Oh, you make these terrible chemicals that are destroying the planet." He said, "This was my answer." He said, "Well, actually, you're the person who uses chemicals in every aspect of your life. I'm the person making sure the chemicals you use and not destroying the planet." I've seen this in insurance. I've seen it in so many different areas that are not exactly, you know, glamorous examples, like working at Pixar for Steve Jobs, or you know, working for a charity trying to cure cancer or treat cancer victims. This is something that can apply in any organization. And you know, it is true that people, you know, in their personal lives, people say, "Oh, where do you work?" And they have an answer. And they could say, "Well, you know, I spend 8 hours a day typing at my computer, you know, doing, you know, this sort of accounting." Or they could have this much higher level of construal where they say, "I'm doing something that I'm actually passionately committed to. I really am, you know, fully engaged in what I'm doing. And it doesn't matter what industry it's in." I've seen it done in high street banking. I've seen it done brilliantly well in almost every sector. Now, getting people to that high level of construal, getting people to really, you know, when they say what they're doing, to really be able to be very clear that this is something that is not simply spending lots of hours doing something, the classic, you know, cliche of, "I'm not laying bricks, I'm building a cathedral," whatever cliche you want to use. That is something that I think is possible, even with, I've seen it done with short-term temporary workers in a way that was completely transformational.
Yeah, there is a story they tell about JFK going to NASA. Do you know the story?
Yeah, I think he was visiting one of the facilities of NASA in Pasadena, and just to see how they're getting on as they were trying to put a man on the moon and return him safely. He was stopped in the corridor by this guy who said, "Mr. President, pleasure to meet you." The president said, "Well, and what's your role here at NASA?" And he said, "My role is helping put the first man on the moon." And he was actually a janitor cleaning the floors. But the reason I like that story, Fuad, and I think it's a very good one, is that if you're going to put a man on the moon, you need clean floors. You need good food in the canteen. You need effective filing. You need every role within NASA. And at the time, NASA was employing hundreds of thousands of people in one of the most astonishing projects in the history of humanity. And yet every single person there, you know, needed to be committed to this much higher level sort of goal, rather than, "Well, it's just a job and, you know, 8 hours a day typing away at a computer." It's not what you do, it's how you frame what you do that really, really matters.
Yeah, that's a great point. And let's talk a little bit about strategy. And strategy was before one of the main focus of business education, MBAs, etc. How is the status of strategy teaching today and focus in organizations as well?
Yeah. So let me be a little bit controversial here and provocative. I have many friends in the strategy department. For me, 20 years ago, the companies that failed typically had the wrong strategy. So if I give, you know, Clay Christensen has some great examples of this. They were building big steel mills when we wanted micro steel mills. They were building big Xerox machines when we wanted small desktop copiers. Or they had small grocery stores when we wanted big out-of-town hypermarkets. You were just doing the wrong thing. And so the point was here, you figure out you need to have the right strategy and then you'll be successful. The problem today is that companies that fail typically have the right strategy. They just can't make it happen. And so what you find is that many faculty in strategy departments at business schools now actually aren't teaching traditional strategy in terms of Porter Matrix, the five forces analysis, blue ocean strategy, core competencies, value-based innovation, all this sort of stuff that is great. But they're not teaching it because when they teach it, they get really bad ratings because people say, yeah, but it's not really very relevant for me in my role. Because the companies that fail today typically fail with the right strategy. And there's some famous examples of this. They just can't make it happen. And so I have colleagues who say, well, Richard, in strategy, we don't teach the what of strategy anymore. We now teach the how of strategy. And they have courses like implementing strategy and things like that. The problem with that is that whilst that's absolutely accurate, that's what my department, organizational behavior, has been teaching for decades. And so there's this sort of merging, if you like, of traditional strategy with this whole issue of how do you actually get stuff to happen in organizations. And there's a real problem here because in life, both at an individual level and I would argue at an organizational level, all of us, and I include myself in this, I don't know about you, Fouad, but all of us, there are things we know we should be doing in our life. We'll just be, you know, they're no-brainers. Our lives would be better if we did them. So at an individual level, it might be, particularly during lockdown, eating more healthily, taking more exercise. Yeah, getting more sleep, reading more, you know, being nicer to the people around us rather than being irritable, things like that. So we know we should be doing them. And if we did them, our lives would be better. So why aren't we doing them? The same is true organizationally. And this is the problem. While strategy consultants can play a crucial role in using their very rigorous techniques, it's the classic sort of MISI analysis that all the top strategy consulting firms use, mutually exclusive and collectively exhaustive analysis. And about a third of London Business School's MBAs go to strategy consulting firms, at least for a few years. And you know, they're an incredibly good process for analyzing data and getting to the right answer. But the problem, and it's a problem for consulting firms, is that you know, they give the right answer, but then the firms don't implement their advice. In fact, there's one project I was involved in years ago now where a consulting firm came to us and said, look, why aren't people implementing our advice? They tell us we did a brilliant job, but they're not actually doing it. And again, the answer is, going back to our socio-technical systems, is are you really paying attention just to the technical system or the social system then? This is the problem with strategy is, strategy is no longer enough to give you competitive advantage, as Porter would call it. And so for me, what I'm obsessed by, and the reason I got into academia in the first place, and the question that's obsessed me in, ever since, and it's the reason I get up before my alarm almost every day, is the question of why aren't we doing the things we know we should be doing? And before I was in academia, I spent a few years working as a psychotherapist, trying to help people work on that question at an individual level. And for the last 20 years, and more than 20 years, I've been helping organizations really reflect on that at an organizational level. And that's not a simple question to answer. There's a whole bunch of things that can really make sort of implementing strategy, making things really effective. One element of this is we've talked about socio-technical systems, but there's a more sort of complex, more recent framework which talks about the need for congruence between all the different elements in the firm. And that is one of the key challenges we face today is, Nadler and Tushman's, David Nadler and Mike Tushman's great writing and research on this, say, look, if there's not sort of coherence and congruence between the formal systems, the informal systems, the people, the strategy, all these different components, if there's not congruence there, then the organization will be less successful. And so today, more of the challenge for senior managers is not to sit there, you know, thinking about the strategy. Because to be honest, you can pay the consultants, you know, our alumni, to come in and give you that analysis. The challenge for senior executives today is to really engage with the organization to help create that alignment, to help create that congruence, to really remove the log jams and the obstacles that are getting in the way of people actually helping the organization achieve its ambition.
That's a great metaphor. I love this thing about congruence. There was a concept that I came across called organizational alignment, which is all about aligning vision, values, system structure, culture.
Yeah, which is a congruence model. Yeah,
that's a great. What do you think about the business education today, and even maybe executive education? Do you think we have made the shift? We still need to make the shift. What does it need to improve, to develop? Yeah,
It's such a great question, Fouad, and it's a complex one. And I think certainly my experience is that organizations around the world have cut back on budgets for learning and development, often quite extremely, to almost nothing. For a whole bunch of reasons. Firstly, we can't get groups of people together to do the classic, you know, 1 week, course at Harvard type face-to-face interaction. And secondly, we're under financial pressure. So, you know, we're just cutting non-essential budgets where we can just delay these things 6 months, a year, whatever. So I think learning development is going through a bit of a crisis right now. But for me, this is a crisis that has roots that go back many, many years. Because again, I want to be provocative here, because if I was head of learning development or head of HR or CEO of a large organization, the fact you send a group of people to a leading business school for a week in itself, and the hope that somehow magically there's going to be some alchemical experience where they will come back and improve their productivity just by having been on this motivating experience, I think is a fantasy. I think the reason that there's a crisis in learning and development is this lack of focus on two things. Number one, what is the ambition for this organization? And how can we develop an intervention that will actually help key people in the firm really deliver against that ambition? So that sort of alignment with the ambition. And I won't mention the name of it, but a few years ago, a large pharmaceutical firm I was asked to come in and talk to them, running a day on change. I've taught change for 20 years. I'm passionate about this. It maybe even comes across. So I sat down with this global head of learning and development. And I said, I'm so excited to work with you. I've done a bit of work with your firm already, and it's a very dynamic firm. And I really want to understand, what are the changes that you're experiencing? What are the behaviors you want to be different after this program? Give me a real insight here into the issues you're facing in your organization, so I can design a day here that's going to be as effective as we can. And she looked at me and said, can't you just do a day on change? I said, well, I could just do a day on change, but we've got an opportunity here to really make it bespoke and really, and she was getting increasingly irritated with me at this point. I mentioned, I said, okay, here's the day. We'll do this and these two things in the morning and these two things in the afternoon. She said, great, that sounds fantastic. And, to be honest, I would have fired that individual if I was their boss, because I think that is entirely inappropriate. Because any L&D intervention has to be strategic. And when I say strategic, what I mean is, if the main board was sitting there, being presented this intervention, they say, that is fantastic. That is, if you can help our executives really develop, change their behaviors and really be more effective at helping us achieve that, that's a great investment. So the first point is strategic alignment. The second point for me that I think is a crisis in L&D is the whole return on investment point. To what degree are you actually measuring the degree to which this intervention has actually delivered against its objectives and is actually helping the organization be more successful? And there's some very simple things that you could do. There's one of my clients, an advertising agency, where I run a mini MBA for them with a bunch of other colleagues. And it's a very successful program. It's run for 12 years and it does great. But one of the things that's most effective about this program is the global HR director, 3 months after this program, calls up every person from around the world who's participated in this and says, okay, and they know this is coming. They say, what are you doing differently? And basically, what return are you giving to us based on the significant investment we've made in your development? And the fact the firms don't do that, and the fact that most people, they go on a training course, and then you have, and that's it. They go back, and how was it? And oh, it was great, and on we get. There's what I call the training decay curve here. And the training decay curve is the impact of the training decays over time. And in fact, typically, the decay curve happens pretty quickly. Typically, within 5 minutes getting back to the office, all your good intentions have evaporated. Because as St. Bernard originally said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And so having good intentions and having, you know, a sort of a list of these are my goals after the course, once you get back to the context of the organization, it just evaporates. And so I think that if I had L&D budgets, I would make sure that not only were we strategically aligned, but we were actually saying to people, not in a, you know, trying to, you know, punish them or whatever, saying, look, we've invested in you. What return are you giving us as an organization on that investment? And there's different ways you can measure it. Just a simple conversation with senior executive and obviously much more rigorous ways you can. And so I think what I'm excited about, one of the few things I'm excited about in terms of a pandemic, is that it is a bit of a forest fire through L&D. And I think, you know, we need to emerge stronger in terms of the interventions we do to make sure they're much more focused, much more, you know, sort of measurable in terms of impact, and holding people accountable for actually changing their behavior. Because most of us, you know, aren't very good at change. We don't like change. We know we should be changing, as I said before, but we just don't do it. So I think for me, I think that L&D isn't going to go back to the good old days. I think it is going to emerge. It's going to be, you know, diminished for probably the next 3 to 5 years by this experience. But that the organizations that really do L&D very well would be much more focused and be much more, you know, a combination of different platforms, some face-to-face, some virtual. But it will also be much more sort of centered in the reality of organizational life.
That's a great, the way you described it. Maybe the word, the good old days, the good old ineffective days. But what you touched on, two things I think they are so powerful. One is when you ask that like professional about what do they want out of this workshop or day, they were not clear about what kind of the behaviors they need. And this is something we are obsessed about the product. We forget about the purpose of the product, which is to change people's behaviors. And then what's the strategic alignment, how, you know, for the future also what's needed. And to me, actually, some of the work that we've done in Agility with the team was about predicting what the business needs. It's not even listening to the business, because it's a little bit like Henry Ford, right? He said that if you want to ask people what they want, they would have to tell you faster, you know, horse. But the whole idea is to predict what the business needs and tell them, hey, what do you think about that? And would this solve your problem? And it's all about solving the problem.
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, the point about making the sort of predictions is that not all of them are going to be right, but I think that's exactly right. There's just a tiny story of this, but it just comes to my mind. There's a friend of mine who ran one of the largest retailers in the US for many years. He just recently retired, and he's a wonderful person and a brilliant executive. He had a world-class personal assistant. She's absolutely, you know, incredible human being. And there's lots of stories I've heard over the years of, and she's met her many times, and she's fantastic. But there was one story where he said to her, "You know what? I think I should move to decaffeinated coffee. I've been reading about it, and I think decaf is the right answer." She paused and said, "Yeah, you moved to decaf 2 years ago." Oh, did I really? And it's just a nice example of somebody who is taking the initiative to sort of, in a sense, do what they think is right rather than waiting to be told what to do. And I think you know, if we take that metaphor to learning and development, that ability to just, you know, if you're just waiting to be fed and told what to do, then you're not going to be successful. You have to really, you know, make sure you sit there and listen to senior executives and try and understand what they meant. But I think you're absolutely right. You've got to make decisions today about what are the behaviors you think are going to drive success in the future, and really tool people up for that. And you know, you have to take that risk, and you may be wrong, and you might in 3 years' time be fired and said, why on earth are you developing people's digital capabilities or, you know, data and analytical capabilities? Why on earth are you doing that? But actually, you know, you have to make a judgment call there. And I think it's particularly important in terms of business capabilities, because there was a classic study produced by the World Economic Forum about 3 or 4 years ago, where they found that of the top five careers that graduates were applying for today, none of them existed 7 years ago. And so I think the whole educational system, not just business education, in a way is not fit for purpose, because are we really developing the capabilities we'll need in the future as opposed to the capabilities we needed often many decades ago?
Yeah, that's a great point. What about the business schools? Do you think they are catching up?
I think... they are catching up, I think different business schools are catching up at different rates, and you know, different staff and faculty are finding this easier versus harder as they go through. So it's very patchy, is my experience of this. But in many ways, that's the benefit of a forest fire. The whole phrase of "don't waste a good crisis" is that, you know, if you are one of the leading international business schools, then you have companies coming to you saying, hey, here's a brief, here's an RFP. Are you interested in pitching for this work? And so you have a pipeline of projects coming to you. And you can just pick and choose which ones you want to go for and which ones you think you're suited for. And so there's no need, in a sense, you're more farmers than you are hunters. Because there's no need to go out hunting when food is, you know, being delivered to your village. So I think what's been happening now is that, you know, it is very stressful for business schools, and it's tough times for all learning organizations. But I think there's a huge opportunity here to really in a sense, reboot what we do and how we do it. And, you know, in the short term, clearly there's an impact on profitability and, you know, furloughing and even redundancies for many institutions, business institutions. Yeah. But I think in the longer term, a bit like we talked about Jack Welch at General Electric, even though he fired 70,000 people, he made the organization lean, strong, and focused. So then it could go through an incredible period of expansion. And I think learning development is more relevant now than it ever has been, because I think the role of senior management is fundamentally different today than it was 10, 20, certainly years ago. And we've talked a lot about that. So I think the business schools have a great opportunity there. But if they're just sitting there, you know, closing their eyes, crossing their fingers, hoping the pandemic goes away and we can get back to the good old days, I think there may still be a very, very small number of business schools that can get away with that. The ones where, you know, no one ever got fired for hiring IBM type business schools, without mentioning any names. But even those ones at some point are going to have to really adapt and be more agile, I would argue. So I think using this crisis to really reboot and retool and make sure that the interventions we really deliver are much more focused on client needs than focused on what faculty like teaching, which is always attention, and really making sure that we are delivering value to organizations, that we can, the head of learning and development, the head of HR, can go to the main board and saying, you gave me this money to invest on behalf of our shareholders, and here's what I've done with that investment, and here's the value we've created. Now, that's not easy to measure. I'm not saying this in a simplistic way, but even if it's qualitative ways of doing that, anecdotal ways, you need to be able to have that conversation, I would argue. And to, for business schools to help the clients really have that strategic conversation to make the head of HR, head of learning development look good within their organization is more than simply having happy sheets at the end of the week's residential course.
That's great. I want to talk with you just in this final section about some personal reflections. And the first one is, what's one success or a couple of success habits which helped you throughout the years? And you have a vast experience working in the academia, but also working in consultancy with leaders and organizations.
I think probably two things I would focus on. One is I am desperately curious. It drives my wife crazy. You'll be watching TV and I'll be, you know, sort of saying, well, hang on, they said that and I want to understand it. In conversation, again, I'm constantly getting my phone out and just trying to understand things. I'm just so keen to understand why things are the way they are. If something I don't understand, I desperately want to understand it. And, you know, anything I get into, I'll sort of want to dive in, you know, deeply in a kind of, you know, sometimes tedious way. So that, you know, relentless curiosity is certainly something that is a key part of who I am. The other thing, perhaps more profoundly than that even, is, you know, at school I was never the smartest kid. I was in the top set, but I was never the smartest kid. You know, at university...
Well, you got the distinction in your MBA, so...
Sure, I'm reasonably academic. But you know, the reason I think I've been successful is not that I was necessarily smarter. It's that I've just tried harder. And anything I do, I will just almost always be trying harder than other people, and that persistence, you know, when things are tough, just to keep on trying. I'm quite tenacious in that way and in my persistence. And so, you know, there's one example of this is, when I was, 7 years old, my parents took me on a ski, trip, in Switzerland. And, again, it's a longer story, but they went off skiing and basically left me on the nursery slopes after about 15 minutes of instruction. Again, I won't go into my traumatic childhood, but basically I had to figure out how to ski. And I had one lift, and it was a T-bar lift, if you know, and I didn't know how to get on it. And the guy at the bottom of the lift only spoke German. I don't speak any German. And so he would talk at me, shout at me and tell me what to do, and I had no idea. So I'd try and get on it, and I'd always fall off. I basically carried on, and eventually I would basically go, you know, a few meters and then fall over, and I would hold on to this thing and it would drag me up to the top of the slope on my backside, that's how I learned to ski, is basically time after time just getting dragged up to the top slope but carrying on doing it. And I think as a metaphor for persistence just not giving up, that's, you know, people who know me would say that that's probably one of my defining characteristics.
That's great. And I usually like to ask this question about how did you keep growing and learning? What's the major vehicle or way that you kept doing so?
The William James once wrote that there are two types of people in life, once born and twice born. And there's a whole bunch of research that people who are successful in life and in their careers typically have had early life traumas and difficult experiences. And there's a whole bunch of things. Research on eminence is one aspect of this. And certainly for me, a lot of people are successful, and you know, to some degree I put myself in this category. Work isn't just earning money. It's something more profound than that. It's what sometimes called a reparative process, which is the world isn't okay as it is right now. And this incredible drive to actually try and improve things. And for me, I was sent away to boarding school when I was 7 years old, and it was a miserable experience for 11 years. The sense that organizations, be it schools or then in my career, organizations I worked in before I moved to academia, the sense that there must be a better way of doing it. This is not a, you know, this is not the Forest of Fontainebleau in spring. And so really from an early age, this sort of sense that, you know, things need to be better. The world isn't okay as it is. I'm not okay as I am. And to really work as sort of repairing who we are, trying to repair the world, trying to actually make things better, is what drives entrepreneurs. It's what drives all successful executives. And I would argue many successful academics as well, is that real drive to that the world isn't okay as it is. And that sort of motivation is something that can stay with you for your entire career.
That's amazing. And what advice do you have for leaders, organizational leaders?
The first piece of advice I would offer is, you know, if there's one gift I would give senior executives in particular, that for me, based on 25 years of consulting and 20 years of academic life, is one gift that I would argue is more valuable than any other gift I would give, it would be the gift of listening. Again, I run an elective at London Business School called Interpersonal Dynamics, where at the heart of it, it is about building better relationships. And the key point here is, you know, if you're going to build effective relationships, you have to be able to give space to the other person to truly listen to them. Firstly, to gather information, to get their ideas, their points of view, but secondly, to make them feel valued. And that ability to make other people feel valued, for me, is one of the absolutely critical skills that I would argue great leaders do. So that's really my one. If there's one piece of advice I would offer, it's just get better at listening. And some of you, in this podcast, might think, "Well, I'm a good listener. I've been listening for years." Well, there's one way I would advise you. If you wanted to, you could test out whether you're a good listener. But to be honest, I wouldn't recommend this. But it's very simple. Basically, you go to your partner and say, "Darling, am I a good listener?" And at that point, you might need to stop listening because you might then get some feedback because all of us are terrible listeners. You know, most of the time, we're just, you know, it's all one-way traffic. We're transmitting. We're not genuinely listening to the other person. And yet, that ability to make other people feel valued is what builds loyalty. It builds that, you know, ability that people do almost anything to support you because you really make them feel this profound connection, what Martin Buber called an IU connection. And I think that is something that really differentiates senior executives from effective leaders. So if you think about your listening, there's a lovely quotation, a cartoon rather, that that I have used many, many times in the classroom, where you've got a man and woman sitting at a restaurant table. And the man's looking very animated and engaged, and the woman's looking rather bored. And the caption at the bottom is the man speaking, and he says, "Enough about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of me?" And all of us love talking about ourselves, and we love, you know, we are our own favorite subject. And that's fine. You've got to be able to think about yourself as a brand and position yourself and promote yourself. But you also need the ability to focus on the other. And so listening, that ability to give other people space, you're not finishing their sentences, you know, genuinely make them feel that you care about them and their answer and their point of view on the world is something that all of us, I would argue, can improve at.
That's excellent. What about young leaders, aspiring leaders?
It's funny. For decades now, or certainly the last 12, 15 years, I've had HR directors say, "Richard, millennials are a problem. Millennials are a problem." And I, in the early days, I thought, no, they're just young people. You know, my parents are losers. You know, every generation has had these intergenerational dynamics, this Freudian thing of the Oedipus complex wanting to kill off the father, the parents. We've all had that. And so I ignored it, if I'm honest. But then, probably about 8 years ago, I taught a group of millennials for the first time. And it was I have to admit, an absolute disaster. They gave me the most cruel and abusive and, you know, vitriolic feedback I'd ever received. And I'm, you know, normally my courses tend to go pretty well and my consulting work goes pretty well. I'm not used to being beaten up quite so extremely. And it was colorful. Now I did, you know, I then went back and listened to them and said, "Hey, what's going wrong?" And eventually, when the whole program went very well, and they really I think appreciated it. But it made me realize that there's something changing here. Briefly on millennials, I think, and not just millennials, but you know, the young generation entering the workplace. I think what they want is what we all want. They want to understand where we're going, and they want to feel that they can contribute. And some of their frustrations that, you know, they've been parented in a way where they've been made to feel that they're great and everything they do is fantastic. Coddling is the name of a wonderful book by Professor NYU Stern, and Jonathan Haidt, this whole thing about have we slightly over-pampered this generation? But certainly, whether we have or not, they've, you know, been to world-class education, and they emerge in their careers wanting, you know, feeling like masters of the universe and wanting to really contribute. And then they basically said, "Look, you know, quieten down. Just, you know, don't say anything in the meeting, and just sit there and do these sort of menial tasks." And they're not very happy about it. They really want to contribute in a more meaningful way. And we did some studies on millennials a few years ago at London Business School, and what we found is that there were two data points that really struck me on it. Millennials assumed they wouldn't stay at the same organization for more than a few years, 2 or 3 years at any point in their career. Because they look at large organizations and say, "Well, you know, I don't really want to work here. You know, doesn't really fulfill me in any profound way." And the other data point from the study was that 72% of these millennials said they don't aspire to be like their senior managers. So they look at senior leaders and say, "I don't want your life. You're a workaholic. You have no relationship with your family, your kids, your friends, your hobbies and interests went years ago. You spend your entire life working. You look terrible. You're out of shape and you look exhausted. You're in a state of chronic sleep deprivation. I don't see you as a role model." And that is new, because that's different. In the past, we'd look up and say, "One day, if I'm successful, I want to be like you." So that's changed. But fundamentally, I think what millennials want is the same as all of us. They're just being more pushy in doing it. And, you know, studies on stress show that the millennial generation is more stressed than any previous generation we've studied. And I think it's because they're just not putting up with all the bad stuff that we used to put up with. You know, some incompetent, abusive boss, some organization we had no idea what the strategy or the ambition was, doing work that really didn't fit with your capabilities. We just put up with it and kept our heads down. So I really admire this generation that they are saying, "No, this is not okay." And I think when I teach millennials, the question that they come up with most often is, "How do I influence up the hierarchy?" I think that's a very important point. And I have one piece of advice on that, which I hope is helpful. The worst thing, and what many millennials do, is they go to their bosses and say, "Look, you're an incompetent manager. You're not doing this properly. You're not doing that properly. You have no strategy. You're doing this wrong." And that, and if you, especially if they've got doing an MBA, they say, "Look, we studied strategy. You guys don't have a strategy. You're doing everything wrong." Now, this is a mistake, because any senior executive, when you go to them and you tell them what's wrong with them, it backfires. Yeah, especially if you're right. And either they ignore you or, you know, end up punishing you. So my advice to anyone about how to influence up the hierarchy is don't do negative reinforcement, which is tell them what's wrong with them. Do positive reinforcement. And so let's say you've got a boss who isn't being clear in their brief to you about what success looks like for you. You could go to them and tell them everything that's wrong with them and be accurate, but it doesn't work. Positive reinforcement is catch the senior manager doing something right. Now, it doesn't mean to catch them doing it perfectly, but if you're in a completely dark room, there may be a slight chink of light there. Focus on that positive and say to them, "Thank you. That was helpful. I really appreciated that. When you did that, that was helpful to me." And if you, in a sense, you have to take responsibility, as Peter Drucker said many years ago, to manage upwards, to manage your boss, rather than just waiting to be fed or instructed by them. And so if you actually take responsibility for managing your boss and you give them clear advice about the things that are helpful to them, this is something that we learned in the early days of behavioral psychology, Skinner and others in their famous experiments here. Actually, if you reward the right behaviors, not just down the organization, but especially up the organization, you'll be much more effective at actually getting them to change their behavior with you.
Interesting. I never heard about using it for managing up, which is excellent application. It makes very much sense. Yeah. My last question to you, Richard, what's the legacy that you'd like to leave behind with all your teaching work, your consultancy work?
The first thing I'll say is I come to this with an element of humility. I mean, all faculty, in my experience, are highly narcissistic, and I have elements of that, but an element of humility, at least, in terms of I don't want to overclaim here. The one thing that I find most rewarding in the work I do is not the happy sheets. Now, I need people to be happy with my courses and, you know, and to give me good evaluation so I don't get fired. But actually, the thing that really means a lot to me is, for example, speaking at an alumni events where somebody comes up to me and says, "Richard, you taught me 10 years ago, and you said something that stayed with me. And it was really helpful. And this is what you said, and this is how it's helped me." And, you know, to be honest, those are the best moments for me, is knowing that individuals that I've connected with, either my consulting work or my academic roles, that actually I've been able to say something that, you know, flicked a switch, and they could see the world, you know, differently. And it's helped them. That for me is incredibly inspiring. And I would hope, and some of my clients, I think, would agree with me that to do that at an organizational level is something that is not straightforward. But that's certainly my ambition, is to try and help organizations do the same thing.
Richard, this has been for me a masterclass in organizational behavior. I'm so inspired. Your passion is contagious. You are on a mission. You've been on a mission, and you continue to be. I think your work is very core to what this podcast is about, the purpose of it, the values, which is about taking care of this central piece of organizations, which makes a big difference, the people aspect, the social aspect. It's your mission, it's your purpose, and we can feel it. You can feel it through your voice, through your words. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know you are very busy with your consultancy work and teaching work. Thank you for taking the time to be with us and share your insights from your journey, from your experience.
An absolute pleasure, Fuad.
And thank you, all of you, for listening for this episode. Please, if you haven't subscribe to the podcast. And I would be very curious to hear your feedback. Please give us a rating or leave a comment on the podcast. Until next time, take care.